This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, you know what that means. It's the music playing. It is time for the greatest Tuesday I've had all week, and this is the True Wealth Show. I'm your host, Dave Littlejohn, in studio today.
Matt Dixon.
And we have got perhaps one of the most unscripted shows you're going to have this year.
Yeah, there's nothing in front of us.
Yeah. And well, because it turns out we just threw curveballs this week. And so I think this may be the curveball show, right? We're going to have to talk a little bit about the curveballs and why it's so relevant, right? You know, there's just a lot of talk in the marketplace, and this has been a big driver of trends for the last really year or two. Some of the biggest players in the large cap space on the planet are all affected by this. It's like a giant black hole for investing. And black hole meaning like it's just a huge gravity event, right? Everything is kind of gets sucked into this ecosystem. And so we need to pay attention to it. But it's simultaneous. It's like a black hole. There's things we know and there's stuff that we don't know yet. Yeah. Right, we're still figuring it out. Scientists are exploring.
Well, I think the big question is, what's happening with AI, and how do we unpack all the information? Because the information's coming at us really, really fast. Different headlines every single week, because this thing is advancing really quickly. And the market's trying to price all that in and trying to figure out where we're headed and how much this thing's really worth. Isn't that the greatest question we can ask ourselves? Like, how big is this AI investment, and how much money will it actually return to the shareholders or the company itself?
And see, I think that you just really eloquently said, like, you summarized the big question, right?
Mm-hmm.
How much money goes into this and how much comes back out of it?
Man.
And within that are just an endless supply of additional questions and variables. But at the very peak, isn't that what we're talking about? Is great. So we've got AI. Well, what does this mean?
Mm-hmm.
And what does it mean for investors? And so I think this is a good opportunity to just talk broadly about some of the things that are going on. Certainly AI appears to have been the thing that upset the market this week.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And when I say upset, I don't mean like, you know, all is lost kind of thing. What I mean is that the stability of the marketplace was shaken. And really, this news came out over the weekend, but it is not just news from, I mean, it's still going on right now. But over the weekend, what was the big announcement?
Yeah, there's this basically a Chinese version of artificial intelligence that is reported to be more powerful than what, you know, inventors in the United States have released to the public. And on that news, there were questions around, well, if, you know, the Chinese have a more powerful platform, then, you know, do companies and services like ChatGPT, like, have less intrinsic value?
Let me fill in some color for this, too, just to make sure we're looking at this through the same lens, right? My understanding is that a Chinese company that's been and the product has been labeled DeepSeek.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so DeepSeek is an artificial intelligence system that they discovered was trainable and would operate at a much lower price point with similar results on lesser horsepower, is in like non-computer terms. So they're able to take an artificial intelligence engine, they're able to train it at a fraction of the cost that it took to train, say, the OpenAI systems of ChatGPT. They're able to run it on processors that are not as powerful and use significantly less energy.
That's a big deal, because energy's been like the crux of mark here.
And
like,
we saw it affected a lot of utility prices. Utilities dropped in value. And here's the weird thinking, I believe. It is, wait a second. What if in all of the engineering we were doing here in the United States, we missed something. China figures out a way to produce a similar result, but on a fraction of the energy use and with less horsepower. Well, companies like NVIDIA that have been leading the charge in the development of artificial intelligence processor chips, all of a sudden they go, well, your chips are not as important because we have software that doesn't need this much horsepower. That affects them. And then you say, and all of you utility companies that have been trying to build more infrastructure so that you could deliver power to data centers.
Right.
Well, we're not going to need as much of that. And so that hits their future value, right? And so the market really aggressively repriced things. At one point, NVIDIA stock, which is like the top three in the world, I think, certainly top five. This is over a $1 trillion valuation, as I understand. And it fell by, at one point, more than 18% intraday.
Right.
A top five company in the world, listen to that again, lost almost 20% of its value in 8 hours.
That's in, I think the report was like over $500 billion in value, just kind of
erased. Yeah, because I think that company's over $2 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you lose 20%, we were talking about hundreds of billions of dollars of value just poof. Right?
Yeah.
And it's all because the future expectations were altered when you think, well, hey, we now could have cheaper AI that takes less power and can run on lesser equipment.
So I did a little bit of looking into this, and kind of what I gathered, and maybe this isn't true, but from my understanding, this is how it worked out. So originally, when OpenAI in the United States was developed, it was quote unquote open. It was transparent. You could see everything and how it was working, and people could
originally it was open source. Yeah.
Right. And you could Microsoft collaborate. Yeah, exactly. And once that happened, OpenAI wasn't really that open anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. And so you didn't get to see behind the veil quite the same way. And then what did we see ChatGPT do? If you want the high horsepower one where they're not capping how much you can use it, exactly, pay up. And then DeepSeek comes along and says, how about we bring back truly open source stuff here where we can collaborate easier? We're not charging for it. And then all of a sudden, it just rocks the foundation of this investment where it's like, oh, well, we were investing in what we thought was truly open AI that kind of got closed off and monetized. And now here, go get a higher horsepower version for free where it's more transparent.
Even if it's the same horsepower for
free. Exactly, yeah.
Because I haven't heard that it's higher horsepower. That's the part I haven't heard. I didn't hear it's more capable. I heard it was similar capability, but it ran. It's like, hey, you can buy the same car when it gets 30% better gas mileage.
Mm.
And you go, well, that's a thing.
Yeah,
that's a
it
big
is.
Deal, right? Like, I get the same vehicle, but I could get like 30% better fuel.
Do you want to go buy this $20,000 car, or we'll give you this one that gets better mileage for free?
Yeah, and, right? And like, that's a really fun way to look at it. You're like, oh man, it's very disruptive.
It is.
Okay, and we've talked
and
about
the market hates.
Yeah, the market had kittens over it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
But
not the whole market.
Not the whole market. And, you know, I mean, didn't you just mention NVIDIA is one of the big stocks that had that massive pullback right out of the gate, drops almost 20%?
Yep.
Well, I think today it finished up 7%. So it clawed back a lot of that loss in a day. I mean, not all of it, but
maybe a quarter of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty big clawback, though.
Well,
and so
the problem, right, by the way, dirty little investment secret that has nothing to do with the markets, has everything to do with math. Problem is, when you fall into a hole, it takes more effort to climb out.
It does.
So, hey, if you lose 10%, let's just do the math, right? You had $100 and you lose 10%. Now you have $90. What if you make 10% now? Right? I lost 10%, I made 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the problem. 10% of $90 is $9.
Yeah, you didn't.
Now you're
get
back,
it back
to $99, not 100.
Mm-hmm.
You're still short.
Right, and this was almost a 20% loss.
Right.
Double that.
Yeah. Well, the crazy was, so if you lose half, you need to make double to get out of the hole. The deeper the hole, the harder it is to fall out, climb out, right?
Yep.
And so that's why loss avoidance is a relevant part of investment strategy, right? It's why just having infinity volatility in your strategy may not be a good strategy. because, as the old expression goes, return of your investment is just as important as return on your investment.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's all relevant, but that's just the numbers of this thing. And so, yeah, when you have almost a 20% pullback, then you got to consider, like, oh, well, $100 is now worth $80.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to make a 25% return to get back to $100.
Yeah.
Right? So if you lose 20, you need 25.
If only someone could just time the market.
Right. Perfectly every time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and guarantee outcomes.
Right.
If only.
If only.
Yeah, and if I find that person, I won't believe them too.
Right?
So, yeah. But this is really a great case study to help people understand, though, because you hinted at this, Matt. Why did the markets, why would it change so much?
Right? Just new. It was news.
Yeah, but the news changes something, right?
Sentiment.
So it, I think it's more than that.
Feel.
I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna take this as our opportunity to, like, you know, segue here. So let's grab a break.
Okay.
We'll come back, and then I'm gonna help sort of unpack, and you're gonna help me, Matt. This will be fun.
Okay.
Is why does the market care so doggone much?
Okay, let's talk. Let's unpack that.
And believe it or not, there's a little bit of math buried in this art. All right, so we'll cover that and more, and we'll even make it interesting. You'll see. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn
and Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, that is the music. We are back. Welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. If you're just joining us, it's Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
And we're unpacking AI a little bit, how the impact in the marketplace, right? There's been a major story this week in particular. A company out of China called DeepSeek introduced a new AI model that potentially rivals ChatGPT and some of the other developing AI programs or AI systems. And the unique feature set seems to be that it's capable of doing the same thing on a lot less power, or on a lot less, when I say power, like physically uses less electricity, or it uses less processing power. So it can use computers that don't have necessarily the latest and greatest technology to pull it off.
Oh, man.
What did you learn?
I just learned, according to DeepSeek's privacy policy, the company stores all of their collected information on secure servers within the People's Republic of China.
Yeah, not surprising at all, right?
Yeah.
So they're totally data mining.
Oh, 100%. So it's like, the government is just collecting data.
Yeah. Well,
and it's like, so it makes me question, like, they say that it runs more efficiently.
Oh, you're gonna head me off, but go for it.
I'm sitting here thinking, like, is this just an advertising slogan for them to try and adopt users? Where it's like, we want you, and we're going to give it to you for free so that we can get your information and use it later.
Yeah, is this just a different version of TikTok?
That's exactly where,
right?
I was taking this.
I mean, like,
this.
Basically,
yeah.
You're looking at this and saying, okay, so if we're going to kick TikTok out, then we want to spy on Americans and their behaviors. So we'll just offer another way in. And what
the
if they
timing,
lied?
Right?
Okay. What if they lied? And the reason that that's a fair question is because China has a history of lying.
Exactly.
Okay. And so this is not to say anything about Chinese people, but the People's Republic of China and the government of China has a history of lying. Okay. And I could say the same about the U.S. government. Right?
Right.
Lots of governments. So, oh, what a shocker there. You can't say, like, oh, you're a racist or this or that. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Are we not allowed to speak truth? I mean, for heaven's sake.
Right.
You know, we had enough of COVID-19 and we know there were lies.
Oh, yeah.
Right. We know there were lies. So, you know, no sunshine on this one. We're just going to get over it and move on. Okay. If they are lying, then the markets are going to be really having to reevaluate their overreaction.
Well, you know what sparked all of this in my mind was comments you've made in the past on this show about, if you're not paying for the product,
you are the product.
Exactly. And I look at this and I'm like, it's free for a reason.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to make either money on it or they're going to get power from it.
Data harvesting, yep. Some kind of, you know, social engineering. You know, keep in mind, like, the algorithms of TikTok, they used a different... Again, this is a little hearsay, but it's coming from credible enough sources that I believe them.
Yes.
The algorithms that Chinese users of TikTok were exposed
superior.
To... Well, they were different than what the U.S. The U.S. was kind of fed, like, bubble gum and whatnot, where China was, like, much more educational content, and it was curating different content to try to advantage their youth over ours.
Well, yeah, and their algorithms have been proven to be more successful than ours. Like, look at the TikTok platform. Yeah, like, it's common
more
knowledge.
Education, they're just looking for different behavioral manipulations, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was part of a social engineering experiment.
100%.
And so when people are like, oh, that's, you're talking conspiracy, I'm like, shut up. No, I'm saying there is such a thing. When you hear the term PSYOP, right, it's a psychological operation. It's an intentional social experiment to see how people respond. And
yes.
I believe that really happened.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And I don't even know that it's crazy. I think you've probably done it yourself in your own household. It's like, well, let's try this and see how
people respond. If I push these buttons, what is my wife's reaction?
Yeah.
We've
so,
all
like,
done it.
I think we've all played these games and like mini social experiments. It's just happening on a grander and more organized scale. So if you don't, you know, if you want to take issue with that, kick rocks. I don't care.
I love it.
Anyway, all of this to get back to the original question of the last segment, Matt. What did the markets, how did they respond to this and why?
I mean, we kind of saw how they responded. It was a knee-jerk reaction.
Right.
There was a big sell-off, and it was the market trying to figure out, you know, with this new competitor being in the space, how much is that going to affect profit margins and sales and business? And it's a lot to digest. And typically what we see is the market errs on the side of caution. We hear some bad news.
Well, they say the markets go down in an elevator and up on an escalator.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So
yeah.
They just drop fast.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we saw.
And if we were to look at a math rationale, somewhere people said we had these projections for future profits.
Mm-hmm.
And as investors, we expect to put money into an investment to buy those future profits. And the future profits were just, at best, reorganized.
You're right.
But at worst, they were endangered or even eliminated. And so it would change the perception of value. And it would happen really quickly. This was new information, not formerly known, that had to be priced into future expectations.
Yes.
And so the markets go bananas.
Mm-hmm.
I just think there's also something to be said for the idea that the markets could fully understand the information they had that quickly.
No.
Is not a fair statement.
It's not logical, right? Like that you instantly can deduct that this company is going to make or be worth 20% yeah. less.
And so I look at this, and this is one of the things that I like to poke at in the efficient market hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, over a 5 or 10 year period, I think the markets tend to be quite efficient.
Yeah.
Things sort of move at a pace where things really do get priced in and you move along. But in the very short term, the idea that the markets are efficient, I don't think we get all the information at the same time. And I think people guess at it. And so what the market knows, air quotes, right?
Yeah.
We're on the radio, but I'm doing air quotes right now. Right? The market knows only what it knows. And some people guess. And the market knows they're guessing only to it may not know anything. It just knows there's a bunch of people. And the sentiment, right? The tilt between supply and demand, buyers and sellers, got all out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of it's us data fitting to try to explain what we just saw. I don't know that you ever really know. Because there's some people that, you know, like they might have tripped and fallen on their keyboard and bought the stock. Right? It could literally have been an accident. Fat fingers.
Hmm.
Did the market know that, or did just dumb stuff happen and we have to kind of build that into the short term?
Right.
That's my question, and that's where I always get into this, the academic issues of how might you take advantage of short-term inefficiencies in the market.
Yeah, I think part of it is just understanding that it's a herd, right? Like, there's a lot of people out there. There's a lot of big hedge fund managers, big companies that are trading lots and lots of money. And if everyone starts to do something, it can start a chain reaction. And I just, like, imagine a bunch of, you know, lemmings running off of a cliff. It's like...
Yeah. And any of you that try to text me about how lemmings don't really do that, I don't care. It's a funny example. Let it go. You know, just... I don't care. Lemmings are hilarious because if it's fiction, the fact that we somehow all learned this legend and ran with it makes us lemmings anyway.
Did you have one of those Sega, the handheld Segas that originally came out and it had the lemmings game where if you didn't herd them correctly, they would run themselves off a cliff?
I did not.
Oh, man. It was a great video game. It was played on like a 2-inch by 2-inch color screen.
But it was color.
That it was color. Oh, man. I thought I was living right, you know.
I remember Game Boys. They were monochrome, you know. So.
Yeah.
Yes. And there's a bunch of hours of my life I'll never see again.
Those 1990s video games were addictive as they could get.
Oh, my gosh. It's like, oh, look, the puzzle that you can't solve. Just keep going. Like, no.
I had the football game and... I was always Brett Favre and the Packers every single time.
Yeah. What I remember as... God, we're so off the beaten path today. But, you know, scripted show, right?
Sure.
Some kid broke Tetris. Actually beat it.
Yeah.
Like, it really happened.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Some 14-year-old kid, like, less maybe about a year ago-ish. Something like that. I'd have to look it up. But the kid got to super high levels.
And the game just...
And it's basically just dropping pieces, like, you know, immediately.
At that point, your mind is a computer.
Like, well, whatever he did, he managed a sequence where the game scrambled and ended. And he defeated Tetris.
That's awesome.
And people were just like, I can't believe it. It's like he just broke the world. Mm-hmm. Right? Somebody beat Tetris. I didn't think you could beat it. I thought just eventually everybody failed out, you know? And no, there was an end. Big deal. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
So.
One day we'll break the internet. Everyone's always talked about, can that day come? It's like,
yeah,
maybe with
didn't
quantum
Kim
computing.
Kardashian try one time? I swear. Oh, man.
Well played. Well
oh,
played.
Oh, man. There's, yeah. You guys break the internet. I'm going to go try living in the real world. Yeah. Where's this? What happened to the phone that you were going to get that was like the doesn't do anything phone?
Oh, I managed to make that phone do that.
Oh, so you don't have to get it now?
No, because that thing is now incapable of
you
like...
almost bricked your phone?
I did, yeah. Like, that thing is only good for like three things. Tells you the time, has a calendar, lets you send a text and a phone call.
What about GPS?
It can GPS too. That's something that you can't really live without. Like maps, if you pull up to the gas station and ask for a map, they're probably going to look at you funny.
Yes.
It does do GPS.
All right, so it's a you've taken a lot off of it, but not all of it.
Basically, like 95% of it's been scrapped.
So the internet's gone.
Yeah, basically. Yep.
All right.
Bought back so much time.
Yes. And then you know what happens? Then he gets antsy because he's run out of things to do.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see. I guess only time will tell, right?
Here's, you know what this sounds like to me, Matthew?
What?
This sounds like you've got bandwidth in your life for some of our listeners that have been like, you know what? I've been considering whether or not a financial planner is appropriate in my life.
It's true.
And what you're saying is you would really like to meet these people.
I would. Whatever they need. You know, see? We're going to see if there's a fit there, whether it's a financial plan or whether it's a trust or whatever it is, we can look at it. If you need someone that can manage money for you, whatever it is, we'll see if it's possible.
I will give a subtle plug. This is typically, we really do focus this show on the information side of things, like just trying to explore topics, talk about how stuff works. But for you personally, we do have actual clients too.
Yeah,
so we do work individually, one-on-one, and client means households, it can mean small businesses, it can mean individuals, it can mean families, but we work with folks And it's a fairly holistic approach. Like, mm-hmm. it's pretty broad-based. When we say the investments, we nerd out about that.
And when,
we
you,
like investments.
When you say, like, holistic there, like, what are some of the bread and butter things that you think that we do well? Like, if you were just like, these are kind of the big pillars of the things that we do often.
So I think some of the things that we do well are tax efficiency, mm-hmm. right? Investing in the right vehicles and being aware of how you're investing to not pay more to the government than you need to.
Okay.
And that's a spectrum. There's no such thing as perfect tax planning, but I think we do a pretty good job of it.
Yeah.
When we talk about planning, which is figuring out what rate of savings you need to accomplish a mission and looking into the future and making sure that you're tracking to get to the path that you're trying to get to, right?
Yeah.
I think we do a good job doing that. Optimization. Okay. Hey, are you in the right vehicles? Like, let's say you haven't been planning, but you're at a spot where you're trying to figure out how to course correct. Mm-hmm. Should we be looking at converting IRAs to Roth IRAs? When should you take Social Security or not? Do I still need to maintain insurance for my family or not? How do I position assets in the right places so that when I retire, I know where to take money from in a sequence where I don't have to give more to the government than I need to. So distribution planning, all of those things are things that I think we do a very good job of.
Wow, that's interesting because, like, my list would be different than that.
Well,
oddly.
I mean, it's not a comprehensive list yet. I think we do a good job helping people navigate the basics of estate planning and wills and trusts and that sort of stuff. Yeah. And it's not because we're practicing law, but it's because we do this a lot. And we navigate these rules and help people kind of figure out what they need.
Right.
Right? I think we do a pretty good job on the insurance side, and we don't even talk about it much.
Yeah,
right?
We never talk about that.
We really don't.
Part.
But, you know, like, is it appropriate to have insurance? Or the bigger one is, like, when do you let it go?
Yeah.
Like, I know people that hang on to insurance for no real financial planning reason anymore, other than it's like a warm blanket.
Well, and it can get really expensive sometimes.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, what if instead of spending $300 a month on that, you just invested that $300? Like, over 20 years, what does that look like?
Right. Well, and the fact that insurance, the death benefit's a stated value, and you bought it years ago, typically, and so the value is less powerful in the future than it is early on. You're losing the power of leverage with time, right?
Yeah.
So all of this sort of analysis stuff, that's what I think of as planning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, investing is the, like, after you've done adequate planning, then you put the money to work so that it starts to grow for you, and it drives your plan. But the planning is, like, the strategies and the architecture to try to make your money work for you.
Yeah. One thing I've heard a lot from people when, you know, just talking about having a relationship with them for a year or two or maybe more is a lot of people say, you know, I was at this one other place and I never understood any of my investments at all. Like, I didn't understand why we were doing what we were doing. I didn't really know anything that I was in. And after working with you guys, like, I have a lot better understanding of the why behind, like, the strategy that we've got going on.
Well, that whole educate, plan, invest.
Yeah, I think
there
that
really is,
the educate piece is often overlooked. Most of the time it's a sale, right? Like, come here. We're going to do magic things. And then everyone leaves and they're like, well, what were the magic things that we did?
Yeah.
And they never know why they did what they were doing.
Yeah. The three pillars were really intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And it was early on is, you know, if you help people understand the why, then it's easier to get buy-in. And then you can ride through because invariably there's going to be bumps on the road, right?
So
you have a strong enough why helps you survive the bumps on the road. And then, you know, the planning is about developing an intentional strategy. And then the investing is when you're executing.
Right.
Right. So those three stages really play out. Speaking of playing out, I'm looking at the clock. We're running long.
Okay.
We got to grab a break. Let's do this. We'll grab it. When we come back, there's more to talk about in AI. There's more to talk about in planning. There's more to talk about. So we'll discover that. But we got to take this break first. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
We got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang. Welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio joined by
Matt Dixon.
And you know what? I want to pivot for a minute on the show. We were talking about this during the break. We've been talking about AI today, and then I shamelessly plugged Matt, who stripped all the stuff off of his phone so that he can have extra time in his life. And what he really said was, come see me. So give us a call, 541-375-0898. Matt could use some heckling or some good old-fashioned financial planning. Although I joke because it's like, if you get more work, I get more work.
It's true.
Right? Because we really do work as a team. It's not like Matt's got his clients and they're, you know, so we're all in it. So, you know, maybe thanks for buying back more time so I can take Friday afternoon off every now and then.
There you go.
Good deal. All right. So here's the question about in all of part of what's driving the economy, you know, this the markets got dinged by the AI issue of, you know, DeepSeek showing up as a new player to the game
right.
that looks to be very competitive and very affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? All right, that's a game changer. So, you know what else is a game changer? Tariffs.
Oh, yeah.
Bunch of policy change. You know, we have seen the Fast and the Furious. It's been about a week now since the inauguration, and we have already seen crazy number of executive orders hitting.
Did you see Colombia? They were going to get hit with a 25% tariff, and the president down there was jawing with Trump, and that went back and forth, and all of a sudden, the Colombia decided to basically comply with all of the stuff Trump wanted to do.
The interesting thing about this is if I were to summarize it this way, what Trump does is, I mean, he's essentially, I think somebody described him as a Jacksonian populist.
Okay.
Okay. And a nationalist. Okay. So he's looking out for the interests of the United States, and he's not terribly concerned about the global
effects.
Collaboration.
Yeah.
Nah, the effects are not unnoticed, but his job, I think he views it as, I'm the leader of United States of America,
not the world.
I'm here to look out for the United States of America.
Yep.
And so if I have the capacity to leverage in a negotiation, I will use it.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of easy to do. Not to like dismiss the challenge of that job, but when you're the biggest player and you got a country that's a really small player, like you can kind of be a bully. And it typically kind of works.
That's the word I was thinking of. The word I was thinking of is bully. And the tough part about it is that a lot of people are, I think this is maybe the biggest summary of the Trump administration is Trump is a bully and talks like one a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Mocks the people that he can lord it over.
Yep.
And is a bully to other countries.
I think Theo Vaughn said it best when he was sitting down with Mark Cuban for an interview. And Mark Cuban was saying, oh, don't vote for Trump. That's a horrible idea. And he asked Theo, so can you just explain to me why you actually want him to be the president? And Theo Vaughn's response was pretty epic. And he's like, so I look at Trump kind of like one of those old school mafia gangsters where it's like, you know, yeah, he's a bully or he's intimidating or he's going to make threats or he's going to do something wild. But at the end of the day, when you're running this country kind of operates like the mafia a little bit. Like if you got to have someone strong enough to do something crazy enough that it's going to play out and people are going to respect you enough to where they're going to listen and the people are going to follow. Other countries are going to get in line. And it's like, yeah, he kind of is that mafia guy, right? Like he's going to do some things that don't look it could be a little shady, but at the end of the day, what do you want out of your president? Do you want someone weak that's just going to bow over and, you
this
know?
This is my take, is that the people that really dislike him, it's like, he's a bully. Look at all these character flaws.
Mm-hmm.
He's a jerk. I don't like him for these reasons. And anybody that voted for him is an idiot because they're overlooking these character flaws.
Right.
And they don't recognize him as a bully. And then I think the people that vote for him largely said, we know he's a bully.
Exactly.
We know there are character flaws. None of this is a surprise. But we're sick and tired of actually negotiating against our own interests.
That's
and,
the
and
big
to
piece.
And to our detriment, right? Like, we look like fools.
Mm-hmm.
When you spend so much money on foreign wars, but you can't take care of your own people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it looks really, really inexplicable.
Yeah.
That like, well, so you'll throw money into an ecosystem where you know it's being laundered. and you'll sort of say, well, but we're trying to be benevolent, but you're not, because the people in your own borders, it's like, well, and this one, like, the real problem for me, right? It has nothing to do with like racism or anything else. But if you let people in the borders that aren't citizens and then give them resources, but the people that are citizens don't get resources, and people skipped the line to cheat in. I'm like, I don't like to see people cheat the system and then benefit for cheating.
Yeah.
If you don't like the way the system is, change the rules so it's not cheating. But don't let people cheat and get rewarded for it. That's just a terrible disincentive to an organized social contract. End of discussion.
Yeah, it is, like, really bothering.
There's just no way to say, well, what about these people that are so good? It's like, yeah, they are, but not all of them are.
Mm-hmm.
And we're making policy for everybody, not for your one case exception.
Well, and when the policy favors people that aren't contributing.
When the policy tells you to do a bad job, that's not okay.
Like, yeah.
Policy says, you know what? Don't immigrate. It's too hard and too expensive, and it won't work. Just cross the border illegally, and then we'll kind of make it work for you.
I think a lot of people just don't understand the drain on the system that causes. Like, look at just healthcare, right? Like, if you show up to the hospital, to the ER, they're going to treat you, right? Like, and if you have zero way to repay the system, who's paying for it?
All of the people that pay for the system are paying for it.
Exactly.
And so, and this happens everywhere, and we've become so accustomed to it that we shrug our shoulders and tolerate it. The problem is, like, we are at the structural tipping point. I'll explain, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're at the tipping point when the government has reached a point where it grows faster than the tax base can keep up.
Well, that's exactly what happened, and I think that's why you've got this government efficiency group.
Well, you have to, because government cannot operate and think like a private industry. It cannot want to become a monopoly and then be restrained by itself. Government is the restraint of capitalism, because unchecked capitalism becomes monopolies. Mm-hmm. And oligopolies, right? It wants to take all the market share and take all the air out of the room. That's its goal. More market share, more profit, win. And the government keeps that in check. But what if the government itself wants to grow itself?
Well, that's what happens.
Every year, spend all the money or it doesn't get reallocated. Hire people, but you can never hold them accountable to performance. Like, these are fundamental flaws in government. And if it gets big enough, it eats the private sector anyway.
Well, it's already happened.
Yes.
That's the problem, is the government's gotten so big at this point to where it is competing against the private sector.
Well, and it's competing against the small market, because the mega players are the ones that largely install the government, and so they are able to effectively sort of navigate what's going on by purchasing the favors, right?
Mm-hmm.
By, if you put the right people in place and you donate to the right campaigns and you keep them in the positions where you're able to get influence, then you create a moat that prevents competition in an otherwise capitalist environment, right? So then you go, well, it's not full capitalism. I said, yeah, but if the government over-restrains it, it's definitely not fair either.
Yeah.
Right? And that's why people have this weird dichotomy of, like, we seem to have two groups. One group that seems to really love the government and hate giant corporations, and another group that seems to love giant corporations and hate the government, and nobody looks at the fact that neither of them really functions fully. Like, big corporations become big corporations because they outcompete everybody else, but once they outcompete everybody else, they make it impossible for any other competition to enter the marketplace, and then it stops being capitalist. And then you have monopolies again, right? So there you
mm-hmm.
go. There is a cycle to it, which is why we don't go for fully unbridled capitalism. We go for what we talked about on this program before. And it's, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? What is an ethical capitalist?
That's a great question.
Right? So maybe we ponder that question for a minute, but I'm looking at the clock. We'll take our last break. And if you're curious what our take is, I'll give you a hint. We had t-shirts made. We might have an opinion. All right. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Can there be such a thing?
Yes.
Right? Matt, we're having the debate. Can there be such a thing as too much brain horsepower? Mm-hmm. And Matt's like, what if it hurts? Welcome back to the True Wealth Show, everybody. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
And you know what? We are going to, in this last segment here, we promised to approach this question. And you know, it's kind of I guess it's a tricky question, but I think there's a pretty straightforward answer.
Okay. Right?
And the question is, what's an ethical capitalist, or what is ethical capitalism?
Okay.
Now, first, why the question, Matt?
Well, I think when we left, we were talking about, you know, if a corporation gets too big, it becomes a monopoly. And then at some point, you would expect the government to kind of step in and try and reverse that a little bit.
That has been the case, right?
It didn't used to,
I think it was Carnegie Steel that became a monopoly, yeah. And then they realized, like, this is a problem.
Right, because in the price, there's no price control. If something is too big,
yeah.
Right?
Well, I would say there's no price discovery, right? If there's only one vendor, and mm-hmm. they hold you, and you have to have something, you're a hostage, right? This was, like, remember a few years ago, the company that had the EpiPens?
Yep.
And they just, like, crank the price up by like 500%. And it's like, well, you know, if you have an allergic reaction and you don't have one of these, you die. And they're like, so pay up, right?
Yeah.
And I think, and the guy ended up going to jail for it, right? Because of price gouging. And some would argue, hey, you know, fair game.
He had the
right
patent to it. And
right. But then others would say, well, wait a second here. Adrenaline is not something that you, or, you know, epinephrine is something that your body naturally makes. You can't patent the drug that's available.
He didn't patent the drug.
He patented a specific delivery mechanism.
Yes.
And then they changed the pricing and everything else. And at some point they were just like, the problem is an ethics problem.
Yeah.
Right? And that was the issue here. And this is where I think the ethical capitalism component is relevant, right? Personally, and we don't have time to go into it on the show, I don't think ethics are any different than morality in that I don't think it's relative.
In what way?
I think morality has to come from an external source. I think if you try to crowdsource morality,
or try and govern it,
well, yeah. It's just a popularity contest.
Well,
here's my case, right? If morality is pliable, then at some point slavery was okay.
Hmm.
And we all seem to agree that it's not okay. And yet, a couple hundred years ago, that was not unusual.
When government tries to mandate all of this, it turns into DEI.
When it goes off the rails.
Yeah.
Because it ceases to be...
Like, if you try and govern morality, you end up with DEI programs. That's really what this comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't necessarily headed in that direction, but, I mean, basically it's... At issue here is the government's not going to be the best arbiter of morality.
No.
Which is why you have these challenges. So the to me, ethical capitalism gets defined this way. All parties in the transaction benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so if you really wanted it to rock, you'd say all parties perceive, not only did they benefit, but they feel like they benefited. Right?
Yeah.
They walk away from the deal saying, I got a good deal here. The person selling feels good about it. The person buying feels good about it. The producers and the parties involved, everybody's like, this was a win. When all the parties feel like they're in a win zone, mm-hmm. then you've really created some great value.
Right.
Now, the problem is that that's subjective in nature, and I recognize that. But I'm saying if everybody felt that way, you did have a great transaction. Okay. The problem is what happens when one party says, I have this value,
yeah.
and it's worth it. And the other party's like, I don't know that it's worth it, but I don't get a choice, right? That was the issue with the EpiPen.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, so you could gouge because it was a hostage situation. And to me, capitalism has to have price discovery. Natural competition allows price discovery. Consumers have to have choice. If there's no choice, then you don't have a capitalist system.
That's a good way to put it.
Right. And so that to me is the crux of all of this. Now, how does this affect your investments? Largely, it doesn't. right? I think the markets do a fair job of price discovery because there's lots of participants, right? So lots of people can buy and sell, and so that means you got a pretty good chance at fair transactions.
Yeah.
But on an individual basis of buying a product from a vendor, that's where the subjectivity comes into play. And so, you know, to some, hey, that expensive restaurant, first of all, expensive is subjective term. And to some people, not worth it. To other people, oh, great experience, totally worth it. All right. Well, then people get to self-select where they go. Right?
Exactly.
And so I think that's the issue is, do you have choice? Do you have alternatives? Does the market allow price discovery? And if so, then that's the closest to ethical capitalism that we find.
That's a good way to describe it. I think that's fair.
Yeah. And so my issue is when governments intervene in ways that they make unnatural markets, they advantage one player over another, then we're talking about, we really do need to examine where are the ethics in that?
Yeah.
You know? And so, and then there have been times historically where culture intervenes in negative ways, right? You know, racism has historically been a thing. And so was it right? Clearly we all feel it was not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, you know, we even crowdsourced it different today. But there was a season in history when a lot of that went on. I'm not saying it's okay. So I'm saying we still have to evaluate these questions every time.
Yeah. So anyway, what would be like your one really big takeaway from today's show that I think the listeners should kind of stick on to?
The biggest takeaway from the show today, AI is changing the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And you cannot ignore that. That's probably the takeaway that's actionable.
Yeah.
Ethical capitalism is something that I think we should all strive for. And, you know, keep that understanding in your framework, and it will help you when you're evaluating your decisions.
I like it.
And beyond that, if it doesn't make sense, find somebody that you like and trust and reach out and help them. There's the music. Perfect. I'll tell you this. Our firm's value system starts with education. And so if that sounds like you, we'd love to talk. Give us a shout, 541-375-0898. But we're out of time. So I guess we better get going. Until next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you need to listen to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.